So today I'm going to talk about basically review some ideas that we've had, and also the background, which I think some of you have heard this kind of story before, but you'll tell me if I should go into more detail or less. But what I'll talk about is the issues that have been longstanding with black hole physics, particularly when one considers them in relation to quantum physics, and basically the ideas that we have put forward for solving these problems. The interesting thing, which I hope to tell you about, is that the, I'll put in the next slide. So here's the background, and go through the story about what the paradoxes are of black holes. And the thing that we discovered a few years ago is that you can actually take Schwarzschild's second paper. He wrote two papers that are famous. One is the most famous, is the exterior Schwarzschild solution, as you all know it. But he also wrote a second paper. And we actually went back and looked at that and actually realized that by pushing on it a bit harder than he would have thought of doing back in 1916, we can actually reproduce this gravitational condensate star idea. So it's actually inherent in general relativity from the very beginning. So I'll try to, that's, I think, of both physics and historical interest. So hopefully be able to go through that. And then, of course, by the end, I'd like to talk about tests of this idea, because that's what we're all about, is to see if these ideas can actually be validated or disproven. So some very basic stuff, which I'm sure you all know. The exterior Schwarzschild metric. So first of all, there are, in general, two functions, which I've called here F and H. So just so you remind you that, in general, they're not equal. But in the vacuum, in the Schwarzschild metric in particular, in vacuum static spherical symmetry, they are equal, equal to 1 minus 2 gm over r. And we all agree that at the origin, there's a singularity, infinite tidal forces, and probably breakdown of general relativity, very similar, actually, to the Coulomb singularity in electrodynamics. And so you certainly need some kind of quantum physics there. But the new feature in gravity is that there's a macroscopic distance, the event horizon, proportional to the mass, where something happens kinematically, at least. You have an infinite blue shift of waves falling in, or corresponding redshift of waves coming out. F and H, space and time interchange. And of course, this is what where the light rays are first completely trapped, and what makes the black hole black. So the usual story, of course, is that this is a purely kinematic singularity, a coordinate problem, and that one can remove it. And we'll just review that briefly. And of course, that story is based on putting Planck's constant to zero, and no stress tensor. It's a vacuum solution. So you put, of course, the source of Einstein's equations equal to zero everywhere, except possibly at the singularity at r equals zero. And it's worth remembering that that is the assumption, even classically, when you analytically continue. So the we call them mathematical black holes because it is basically a mathematical procedure to analytically continue the solution inside. Classical matter reaches the horizon in a finite proper time. And so in order to complete the geodesics, you have to do something there. You can't just ignore the interior. But the usual story is that the local Riemann tensor field strength is small, goes like 1 over m squared. And so for a large object, it's quite small. And you imagine that you ought to be able to continue to use general relativity and just remove the coordinate transformation. There's an interesting long story about this historically, which I won't go into. But what you now learn in the textbooks is basically the Kruskal coordinates originally anticipated by both Finkelstein and Eddington way back in the 20s. And then you can basically rewrite the metric in these new coordinates, and then the singularity at r equals 2m is removed. So this, it's not often emphasized, is a complex analytic continuation. And then you get, so it's not obvious, I think you should say from the start, that you can analytically continue coordinates to complex values. But if you allow to do so around this singularity, then you get the so-called maximal analytic extension, which suppressing the angular coordinates and just in the RT plane, you have this familiar Carter-Penrose diagram. So here showing the world line of a typical infallen particle. The horizon is now regular. That's the future horizon. That's the past or anti-horizon. So of course, the vacuum solution, as Einstein's equations are, have a time reversal symmetry. And so you get not only black holes, but white holes. And you usually ignore that and say you don't make those in the universe, and it's only the future that's relevant. But Einstein's equations allow both. The next big step, of course, was putting angular momentum into the game. And Roy Kerr gave us the Kerr solution, which is written here in the familiar coordinates. And this has some even new features, the ergo region, which pulls observers around. There's a region in which you cannot remain stationary and have to rotate through the extreme form of the lens steering effect. But if you look at the interior of this, it's even more fun. You have the maximal analytic extension has all these actually infinite number of black holes and white holes, parallel universes, more singularities, even closed time-like curves. So you know, this is the stuff, of course, science fiction is made of. And say hello to your great-grandparents and have all kinds of fun with this, talking about going to very distant places in the universe. But this is what you actually get from the maximal analytic extension of the Kerr solution. And I actually asked Roy Kerr once what he thought about this, and he gave me a very nice answer. He said, you know, sometimes in order to solve equations, you have to make assumptions. It doesn't necessarily mean that's the way it is. slightly misquoting, but basically he said, you know, it's a mathematical solution. I think that was just the right answer, actually. So now the story gets interesting. In the early 70s, Christa Dulo, and then followed on by several others, proved and then Hawking and others in Cambridge. There was a lot of activity at that period, and several nice things were established. One is the No-Hair theorem that my collaborator Pavel Mazur worked on that as a graduate student and made some interesting contributions, Robertson and others. And with sufficiently stringent boundary conditions on the horizon, you can prove that the Einstein equations give you a unique solution, and it's all given in terms of the exterior quantities, the mass, the total angular momentum, and the electric charge. And this is called No-Hair theorem because there's nothing left over.
Nothing.
Except these quantum numbers, these classical things, quantities left over after the object has supposedly formed. And Christa Dulo proved this beautiful theorem that there's something called the irreducible mass, which whose square is proportional to the area of the horizon. And if you have a suitable restrictions on the energy, namely it's positive, energy falling in is positive, then you can prove, Christa Dulo proved, that the irreducible mass squared always increases, namely the area always increases. So this generalizes the naive idea that energy falling in has to increase the mass of the hole to the case where you have angular momentum and electric charge, and there's a corresponding quantity, which is dependent on the area. So this, again, should be emphasized, is a purely classical theorem. It has nothing to do, there's no H-bars in this in these relations. And the first law for nearby solutions, I guess in fancy language now we might call them moduli, that you have parameters that determine the classical solutions. And if you move from one to the other, the mass changes as the area, the angular momentum, and the charge changes this way in terms of the angular velocity and the electrostatic potential. And the quantity which appears here is the so-called surface gravity, which is given by this formula in general. So this is all classical, and no H-bars, no Boltzmann's constant. And you know, I can't help but remark that if you probably gave this to an astute undergraduate and asked, he or she might ask you, well, what does it mean for the energy to depend on the area? Well, you know, if you know anything about bubbles in fluids or gases, you know that the energy depends on the area through a differential law like that, and this quantity is the surface tension. That's what you would identify with. But there's supposed to be no surface there, right? It's all mathematics. How about entropy? So as we know, Wheeler was pestering his students in Princeton in those days and asking, what happens when you drop a hot cup of tea into a black hole? Its entropy seems to disappear, and therefore it seems like you're violating the second law of thermodynamics. And then Bekenstein came up with his famous proposal that the area, which always increases classically, should actually be proportional to the entropy. Again, you should think a little bit about this before you swallow it whole, right? I mean, it's a classical solution. So what is the entropy of other classical solutions, like the Coulomb potential? We usually don't talk about its entropy. But you still have this problem of matter disappearing. So then you have a question of units. You know, we're all very sophisticated, so we don't use units anymore. We forgot about H-bar. But it's a good idea to put it in and just see what's going on, because the physics is there's no length scale in general relativity to normalize the area by. You need to divide the area by a length squared and multiply by Boltzmann's constant in order to get an entropy. So there is no such constant in classical theory. Of course, if I allow myself to introduce H-bar, then I have the Planck length. So the Planck length squared is an area, and that's basically what Bekenstein did. He introduced the quantum length scale, the Planck scale, which is a very short scale, 10 to minus 33 centimeters. And so the area measured in those units of a macroscopic object is, of course, huge. And Hawking himself was very skeptical about this until he persuaded himself and most of us that in order to have an entropy, you should have a temperature. And his famous argument that there is a temperature associated, this is for the non-rotating, non-charged black hole, which is inversely proportional to its mass. So in that case, everything seems to fit together, right? Because now this classical relation that we have here with the energy and the area, if I divide by the right units here and multiply by the corresponding units here, I haven't changed the relation. I've just multiplied and divided by constants, but then interpret this relation as a first law of thermodynamics, where this is the temperature and this is the entropy. The area is proportional to the entropy, and you fix the constant here to be 1/4, so it's the famous 1/4 area law. But notice what happened. By putting in the units, you've essentially taken a classical relation and multiplied and divided by H bar in some judicious way. Okay. Normally, that's not what we do in quantum mechanics. But okay, let's just note that and go on. And then, of course, we have a story that goes on for about 4 decades, which is, well, there are a bunch of issues, right? So H bar I just mentioned, as people recognize pretty quickly, just because you have a finite temperature of radiation coming out, which is small but finite, if you look at the blue shifted radiation as it was coming out, it seems to imply that the frequencies of those quanta where they originated near to the horizon would be transplanckian. If they're up to the Planck scale or beyond, then I really trust a semi-classical approximation, which is what Hawking used. Then, you know, thinking about it from a thermodynamic or low temperature physicist's point of view, you know, we have low temperature systems in the laboratory, but usually when you cool a system down, you get fewer quantum states and the entropy gets smaller. Here, because of the way, you know, you've divided and multiplied, the temperature going to zero, one over the mass, means if you have a very big mass, you have a huge entropy. So these things are inversely related. That seems weird. As many people noticed and provoked an entire field of holography, the black hole entropy is proportional to the area, which is non-extensive. Usually it's proportional to the volume. It's also non-extensive in other senses because the entropy is a pure number here, you know, in terms of these constants, has nothing to do with the number of degrees of freedom. So if I discover more neutrino species tomorrow, I would normally say there are more states available in the universe, and therefore the entropy should somehow increase, certainly would increase cosmologically, but in the black hole, it doesn't change. So it doesn't. It's non-extensive also in the number of fields. It's nice to put in numbers again and see how big it is. I'll come back to that.
Well, in that argument, you have gamma that you have to fix, so you could then play with gamma.
You can play with gamma, but then you're going to destroy this nice relation.
Sure.
Okay, which is one of the main heuristic
support. So the opposite would say this shows that gravity knows about everything.
Now gravity knows about everything, yes. I mean, there's
no problem.
Yeah, no problem. Okay. Okay, so you've all heard this story. So, I'm just stating the facts, okay? But I obviously have an opinion about all this, and that's what I'm going to get to. So, you know, as Hawking himself realized very, very early, in the mid-70s, if the mass is inversely proportional to the temperature inversely proportional to the mass, then dE dt is negative. Now, again, if you open up your statistical mechanics textbooks, you learn, actually due to Einstein, that the heat capacity of a system, the EDT, is proportional to the fluctuations in the energy, H minus E squared. And if you have anything like an ensemble that makes sense, the average of a positive quantity should be positive. But here it's negative. Usually that tells you you have a very unstable system and you're not, you can't apply equilibrium thermodynamics. But nevertheless, we go ahead and do it. And by the way, it's not only negative, but its magnitude is huge, which means the timescales should be very short for any instability. And then we have this long story where lots of people have worked on various points of view of, you know, what's going on. So you've eliminated the problem with the second law by attributing a large entropy to this area of the black hole, but you've just pushed the problem really somewhere else, because now you have to ask where all the information that fell in that increases the entropy, where did it go? And as you know, Hawking famously proposed that pure states go to mixed states, unitarity is violated. So quantum mechanics, which is the basis of what we're doing here, is now being overturned. And he backed off from that. So I think it's fair to say there's still an open question here. And what is the microstate interpretation of the entropy where you have to count up microstates? So,
this unstability in the negative heat capacity is that beyond the Hawking radiation is also result of some instability, maybe,
but the time scale, that's the point here about the magnitudes. The time scale for Hawking effect is, of course, very slow, because the temperature is very low. So for a big black hole, it takes a long time to radiate. So that, I don't think, has anything to do with this instability scale. But of course, I am using the temperature. So, I mean, it's confusing, I think it's fair to say. So what is the time scale of this instability? What instability does this correspond to is less obvious. That is,
can we interpret and say that because the black holes are, like in the central field, where are things seem to be stable, look at GR or something, this may point at something wrong about GR.
I mean, it's a mundane interpretation, which is that if you talk about thermal equilibrium, you normally talk about extensive systems, which would be infinite and have some finite temperature.
Yeah.
You put a black hole in there, it will just eat up the radiation and grow bigger and bigger and bigger. So obviously it's unstable. Eventually it will eat the whole system. So it's for a very mundane reason that.
But you don't have
well, okay. I mean, skipping over this, but obviously, there are questions about gravity from the beginning, from an attractive force. What does equilibrium mean? I don't want to go there. I mean, you know, there are things like globular clusters people sometimes raise, but the point is that that's a metastable state in which you can live for a very long time. And it's not really relevant to this, I think. Also, you know, the sun radiates, but that doesn't mean we can't have a stable equilibrium. I mean, it's a slow leakage of radiation over very long times, but on the timescales of the lifetime of the sun, I mean, it takes the lifetime of the sun to lose all its energy, right? We can go into all these points, but I'd rather not at this point. Yeah.
Well, what the time scale of the pole, it takes 10 to 67 years to evaporate.
Yeah. So that's
a long time.
That's a long time. Yeah. Yeah. The entropy, by the way, is some. Yeah. I'll get to it. Okay. So you know, if you're worried about counting microstates, you ought to be worried, right? That's what people have been worried about. And you know, this guy worried about him a lot. That's why it's on his gravestone. And I just find it amusing. He's not very happy, right? But, yeah, very dour look. Okay, yeah. So I give you another little cute argument, which I think is in the literature for a long time. So if you try to just, you know, you don't know almost nothing except about black body radiation. You try to estimate what the entropy of a self-gravitating system is. Well, you would do something very naive like this and say the energy should be proportional to the volume times T to the fourth. The entropy is the volume times T cubed. So if I solve for the entropy in terms, get rid of the temperature from these relations, I get this scaling with volume and energy. And then if I say the volume is radius cubed, so it scales this way. And then if I say that the energy is the mass and the radius is also the mass in gravitational units, then I immediately get a 3/2 power law. Okay. And by the way, this I think is right. I mean, it's in Zeldovich's book. This is the approximate entropy of a star which is dominated by its radiation pressure. Our sun has less entropy than this because it's not dominated by its radiation pressure. It's dominated by perfect fluid gas law. But if the sun were, you know, if you get to a 50 solar mass or 100 solar mass star, radiation pressure is much bigger, and this presumably is the right entropy. In any case, you don't get entropy going like m squared. And the factor that's different in these gravitational units is m over m Planck to the square root, which, you know, is a mere factor of 10 to the 19th for a solar mass object. So that, of course, is the problem, that if you're off in the entropy by a factor of 10 to the 19, then you're off in the microstate counting by an exponential of 10 to the 19.
But you have left aside the entropy of the gravitation field produced by the sun. In the case of the black hole, the entropy is just the entropy of the gravitational field. Here you count it.
Yeah, this is very naive, of course. I don't claim this is it's, you know, it's order of magnitude right for relativist star.
So you would have to say that the process of the star falling inside its event horizon would be dramatic.
Something dramatic is clearly has to happen, right?
Let's say you have a star. The star has a gravitational field, and there are some number of states there.
Well, if you do this for radiation gas star, this is the right entropy.
No,
so go and do it.
Star.
Even self grunt.
That's the entropy in matter.
Yeah.
Degrees of freedom. Right?
Yeah.
Where, for any entropy of the gravitational.
No, you solve Einstein's equations, and the Einstein equations you know, there's no, if it's a classical solution, there's no additional entropy.
No, we're just talking to people. If I'm solving a vacuum, answer the question out of that code, we just got an answer that has a huge amount of entropy.
Yeah,
but it's problematic. That's what I'm saying. So yeah.
There are probably somewhere else.
Well,
the understanding questions, and there are no horizons.
Yeah.
Do you think there's entropy?
Yes.
So some people would say the entropy is only a system.
Yeah, that
I mean, you're solving classical equations, right? Yeah, yeah. And if that's right, if the entropy is coming from the matter, then you put your finger on it. I mean, okay, we really believe black holes form by a sudden collapse in a dramatic process, but you know, we can think about, at least as a thought experiment, an adiabatic process. And adiabatically, I could imagine turning down the nuclear furnace, so I gradually, the star contracts. At every point, it seems to have an entropy that's far, far, far below the black hole entropy. And suddenly it reaches the horizon, and I'm told it's jumped by 10 to the 19th.
I think I could say, well, everything is made up by the number of degrees of freedom and gravitational field that we see.
Okay, but the challenge is to do that, to count those degrees of freedom. Okay. I could probably skip this because I'm getting late, but I mean, you should also think about what's going on. I already mentioned the trans-Planckian problem. Of course, kinematically, you have a redshift or blue shift factor so that the local frequencies are being blue shifted compared to infinity, which is no problem at all classically, right? But if I'm doing quantum mechanics, then energies are proportional to h bar omega, and this could produce large energies on the horizon. So you should already be worried that the h bar goes to zero and the limit to the horizon don't necessarily commute. And by the way, when we talk about coordinate transformations, we say, well, that's now just going to classical coordinate transformation. But it's a singular coordinate transformation. And we know in quantum field theory, in classical field theory even, if you make singular transformations, they're not always completely free of effects, right? I mean, you could take the vorticity in a fluid and try to gauge away the singularity, and you would miss the vortex. So that's a singular gauge transformation. This is a singular coordinate transformation.
So this Lucian frequency, that's the frequency that we see by an observer who's at rest.
Sitting at rest.
Sitting at rest, which means that observer is actually accelerating.
That's right.
So you could think of this as simply an Unruh effect.
That's right. I mean, it's kinematics. It's nothing. However, you know, if you start calculating quantum stress tensors, then it's well known, again, back to the 70s, that depending on the state that you calculate the stress tensor renormalized expectation value in, that you will basically get this kind of scaling, or can get this kind of scaling, which means since this is energy frequency to the fourth, this will go to the power minus 2, which means you can get possibly large effects there. Now, usually people say, again, don't look at those states, you know. So,
this quantum is also not well defined. I mean, there's always a zero point ambiguity. In this case, there's an initial two parameters. Quantum field theory doesn't fix it.
Well, this is just subtracting the zero point at infinity.
Quantum field theory doesn't go down zero. And there's, in this case, there's an initial two parameter, at least. Maybe you don't agree.
What two parameter are you thinking about?
Perhaps right in terms of curvature and variance, there are other parameters you usually call it. Maybe you don't agree with that.
No, I'd like to understand what you mean. I didn't. But this is a.
The common was an elementary one that among the new organic fields, just as quantum theory knows nothing about this. So saying this value is this.
Well, you're subtracting the zero point at. In flat space. That's no, well, that is okay. I mean, I think it can be made well defined, but we can talk. It's a technical issue, so let's talk about it. But the little lesson you get from this, by the way, is that these effects, you know, may or may not be there, but they are dependent on the state you choose, which means it's a quantum effect. It's not purely local. So you cannot express this just in terms of the local curvature invariance. The local curvature invariance, everyone agrees, are small. But nevertheless, due to quantum effects of waves, not particles, waves on coherent scales of the order of the horizon itself can give rise to these kinds of things. These are calculations in the literature. It's a non-local effect. That's all I want to say. Yeah.
We didn't know much. Surface gravity near a tensor or mass black hole. It's billions of kilometers per second.
Yes.
Huge.
Yes. Okay. Okay, but you know, that's comparing it to human scale, so that's not necessarily the right thing to do. Right. I mean, we have to take it on its own term. Here the point is, everyone says quantum effects are small. Indeed, there's an H bar and there's a 1 over m to the fourth suppression, which for a large object is very, very small. But if you have this kind of behavior near the horizon, it doesn't matter how small the coefficient is, it can eventually beat that. Okay.
This is infinitely accelerated observer, right? So you're talking about observer with constant r.
Yeah. This is not an observer-dependent quantity. This is the expectation value of an operator in a state. So there's no observer here.
Well, if you want to measure the local energy density, it's always observer-dependent.
No. It's a tensor. It's an expectation value of a tensor. And if I put one index up and one index down, then this is a transforms as a.
But you need to evaluate. This is some component of the tensor.
Yeah, yeah. But if you put one up and one down, and for example, think of this as a 4x4 matrix, then its eigenvalues of that matrix are coordinate invariant. So it's not an observer dependent quantity. It's a question. It's a state-dependent quantity, and the question is that really going to? Is that state realistic? That's the question you should be asked, not about observers.
I guess the observer change can also go into the choice of the state, but we are, I guess, a fixed state observer.
I buried a lot in what these brackets mean, right? But we can go into that. I'm happy to. But let me. This is all stuff you probably mostly know. So let's get past it. And I'm just stating, I think, what the issues are, and you can have your own opinion. So, there is these various issues. But going back to first principles, of course, the main reason why people change their opinion, and even today, most people think there are black holes, it goes back to the singularity theorems and the energy conditions. So if you take Hawking and Penrose proved these theorems that if the energy momentum tensor, its components, and here let's just take the three partial pressures, again diagonalizing it, and the three pressures in the three directions, and the energy density. So this is the strong energy condition, and there's also another form of the singularity theorems, which is based on the weak energy condition, rho plus any of the p's greater than or equal to zero. But we well know that these conditions, which seem eminently reasonable for classical physics, are violated in quantum theory. That the Casimir effect, for example, measured in the laboratory, dark energy we now know about, inflation, all violate these conditions. And what seems to be less well known in the gravitational community is that in the bag model of hadronic physics, you assume there's a bag constant to fit the parameters of nuclear physics, and that bag constant is nothing else but a vacuum energy. So it also violates, of course you don't care about the gravitational effects inside a proton, but it's very small, but it does also in principle violate this condition. So, and these singularity theorems are extremely reasonable, right? Because they tell you that if you have these conditions on the energy, that basically you have focusing of geodesics, and once you get inside a horizon, you're stuck. Everything has to go to a singularity. There's no way out, just by causality and positivity of these quantities. But negative pressure violates that and acts as an effect of repulsion, right? We hear about that when we talk about cosmology. So back in the early 2000s, Pavel Mazur and I were thinking about all these things. And basically, we first argued by analogy, and now I'm going to try to give you a little bit better argument. But the analogy is based on Bose condensation. That, you know, we all know that Bose-Einstein condensation is a very ubiquitous phenomenon, that bosons can fall into the same ground state. If your interactions, even if they're repulsive, if they're not too strong, at low enough temperatures, you'll eventually form a condensate in almost every Bose system. Superfluids, superconductors, gases, and of course, in relativistic quantum field theory, the quark condensates and the Higgs condensate, the Higgs expectation value, are also examples of this. So gravity, we thought, well, gee, it's a theory of spin two bosons. Its interactions are attractive. If there can be strong interactions, like from these states that I just showed you, near the Schwarzschild radius, then something can give there. And this is a quantum coherence effect. And then how would you describe it in an effective field theory? Well, we kind of know what to do from inflation, right? If we have a scalar field, it has to enter the Einstein equations, basically with some potential. If the derivatives of this field are small, then this looks like a vacuum energy, a rho equals minus p equation of state. And now if you also think of it from a thermodynamic point of view, the Gibbs relation tells you that rho plus p equals zero is a zero entropy state. So this is for zero chemical potential. If there's no conserved quantum numbers, then rho plus p equals zero is a vacuum state. It's a state in which you have a single macroscopic condensate, and the log of the number of states is zero. Okay, it's a macroscopic quantum state, and it violates the energy conditions. So dark energy can act as a repulsive core, provided I can make dark energy in the core. And ideas like this actually go back in some less developed way to Zakharov and Zeldovich in the former Soviet Union. So the idea was, well, if you had a gravitational Bose-Einstein condensation phenomenon in gravity, and of course we're groping for how to describe it, then you could form this p equals minus rho interior, and a compact cold stellar remnant could be left over. So we first had this idea back in 2001. It took 3 years to publish the paper, by the way, because PRL wouldn't accept it. Later on realized that this could actually could have been found in some sense by Schwarzschild almost 100 years earlier. So let's go back and look at that, because that's kind of fun. I want to get that message across. So go back. Remember, there are two metric functions. Let's assume static spherical symmetry. We're looking for a static spherically symmetric object. Simple, okay? I'm not talking about formation. I just want to know what kind of objects I can describe in general relativity. So the stress tensor has to have this form. If it's static and spherically symmetric, the radial pressure need not be identical to the transverse pressure. So I put here a p perp for the theta phi components. The Einstein equations are the usual Newtonian-looking equation for the Misner-Sharp mass m, which is appearing in the GRR component, and this second equation in the TT component. And you have the conservation equation, or hydrostatic equilibrium equation. So all these, so you have five functions, f of r, I'll call it m of r or h of r, and the three terms in the stress tensor. You have five functions of r, and you have three first order ordinary differential equations in r. So obviously the system is not determined. So I'm going to come back to this. Skip it for the moment. It's the question of which order to do it. So those are the equations. What Buchtal proved, this is a second piece of information that I'm not sure everyone knows about. It's not always emphasized in GR courses. But in a very nice paper in 59, Buchtal proved that under these assumptions, namely static, spherical symmetry, this metric, and he then also assumed isotropic pressure, so p perp is equal to p, so you eliminate one of the, you give an additional relation, which now means you have only you have three equations for four unknowns. But that is sufficient, he proved, that if the energy density is a monotonically non-increasing function of r, so d rho dr is less than or equal to zero. So that seems pretty reasonable. If the energy density is not increasing as you go out in r, then he proved from those first order equations, just manipulating them, that unless r is greater than 9/8 the Schwarzschild radius, something that the solution has to be singular. Pressure must diverge in the interior. And this is very interesting because this applies to any equation of state. No assumption about equation of state, only that p, all the pressures are equal, and only static spherical symmetry in the Einstein equations. And it's also very interesting, right, that this occurs at a value bigger than the Schwarzschild radius. Of course, you would expect something would happen at the Schwarzschild radius, but this is at a value larger than the Schwarzschild radius by 12.5%. So that makes it interesting to look at the critical case where rho dr is equal to zero and see what happens there. And in fact, that's what Schwarzschild actually did. So the importance of this bound is that it says that no matter what the equation of state is, doadoesn't matter, under adiabatic compression, something has to give at some finite value outside the Schwarzschild radius. So let's look at the static solution, and that's Schwarzschild's second paper. He just tried to generalize, he was interested in stars, he didn't know anything about black holes, and he just said, well, okay, I have the exterior solution, what could be in the interior? I don't know how to solve the equations, they're underdetermined, so let's look at a toy model, basically. Let's assume that rho is a constant, and I'll just parameterize it in terms of its total mass and total radius this way. And then the only equation you have to solve, basically, you can eliminate df dr between these two, and then you just solve it for the pressure. And this is in some textbooks. I think it's in Weinberg's book and Wall's book. So it's a simple exercise to solve those equations. And you find this solution, p of r plus this constant density is equal to this, where d is this denominator. And so this rs is the Schwarzschild radius, r is the radius of the object, and little r is the variable, the radial variable. And f of r, the other functions, are given by this denominator squared over 4, and this function is the radial component of the metric. Okay, so it's a simple exercise just to solve this. Okay, now you see something does happen when this denominator vanishes. Where does that denominator vanish? Well, it vanishes, so here it's rewritten again, the pressure. It diverges if r becomes equal to 9/8, the Schwarzschild, I put this equal to zero, it first diverges at the origin if r is equal to 9/8 the Schwarzschild radius. But if this radius is actually continued to below the Schwarzschild radius, this r naught increases from zero outwards. Okay, so this is basically what we did when we looked at it again in 2015. We said, oh, okay, this solution is there. What actually happens to it if I go further, if I keep insisting on static spherical symmetry below this 9/8 Fouquet bound? So, you know, everyone stopped there for almost 100 years. They said it. Weinberg says it's singular. Forget it, okay? So we said, let's see what happens, okay? So what happens is that this singularity moves outwards, okay? It's all radially symmetric, so it moves to a radius r naught. And the pressure inside becomes negative for the trivial reason that the denominator goes through zero, so the signs change here, okay? And you can see what happens. As you approach 9/8, the pressure gets bigger and bigger near the origin. Here you're just above 9/8. And then as you go through 9/8, the pressure goes up to infinity, but then the negative pressure solution opens up inside. And marvelously, as I keep going all the way down to the Schwarzschild radius, that pressure just becomes equal to minus the rho. So that's the vacuum interior, okay? And very important, the time function, the function sitting out in front of the t coordinates, is proportional to the same denominator. So where that vanishes, there's a cusp. F goes to zero as I get to bigger and bigger as this RNR grows. And so it's a cusp there, but it's proportional to the square, so it never goes negative. So it's not a black hole inside. Okay. And notice what happens as R reaches the Schwarzschild radius. As you reach the Schwarzschild radius from outside, from inside, this R naught, this value where this cusp is, grows from zero out to the Schwarzschild radius. So when you're finally done, you have a P equals minus rho interior. The cusp actually disappears. It becomes, there's a theta function here. Okay. And this redshift function, the root f, has this cusp-like behavior. So it's not analytic. The derivatives change sign. And the interior is actually a part of De Sitter space. It's a static, spherically symmetric representation of De Sitter space in static coordinates. There's an interesting factor of a quarter, which just amounts to redefining the static De Sitter time. So time runs slower inside. But otherwise, it's De Sitter space with this cusp. So what does this mean? Well, you now take some things that Schwarzschild didn't know about, and we have some more modern tools. Komar showed us back in 59 to 60s how to interpret static spherically symmetric solutions in terms of the surface gravity. So the definition of the surface gravity is this. It, of course, becomes Newtonian. Thing you're familiar with at large distances. But in general, for this general spherically symmetric metric is this. And by, again, manipulating Einstein's equations, you can write what looks like Gauss's law. That's what Komar was interested in, was how do you write the analog of Gauss's law for general relativity. And you see, this looks like the divergence in spherical coordinates of something which is like a field, an electric field, but it's the gravitational acceleration. And the thing that appears on the right is not the energy density, but this combination of things. So you get, in this way, by integrating, you get the total mass of the object, which is a completely different formula than the Misner-Sharp mass. But of course, they agree on the outside. So the cusp in this solution, you just analyze everything now. You have a static solution sitting in front of you. And basically, what's happening is, if you go back and look at this equation, here I kept the p minus p perp. If they're equal, this term is zero. But when p gets a discontinuous derivative, the only way you can interpret that is if you integrate this equation, it means that this thing is getting a delta function at that place. Okay, so that is what you can show. That the discontinuity means that there is a surface tension proportional to the perpendicular pressure becoming different than the radial pressure. So there's a delta function at that radius. And if I take this radius all the way to the Schwarzschild radius, I just get conservation of energy again. The total mass is now the volume term plus the surface term. And the discontinuity in the surface gravities is really a surface tension. So by doing the matching and taking account of that delta function, you can see that this is the surface tension. It's the discontinuity in the kappas. So we change the black hole formula, which has kappa dA. It's delta kappa, because there's a discontinuity in the surface gravities occurring there. Okay, and then you can go back and look at the first law. The first law is still true. Energy is still conserved. The mass is now I've ignored angular momentum here. This is static and spherically symmetric. The mass is the volume and an area term. And the surface area is, of course, just the area. The surface gravity is the surface tension. It has nothing to do with temperature, at least in this construction. And there's no horizon. It's truly static. T is a global time. So because it's a global time, if you quantize fields on this background, you can construct ground states, everything's unitary, there's no singularity inside, and there's no problem, there's no information loss. And this, again, if you go back and look at the Gibbs relation, rho plus b inside equals zero is telling you that there's no entropy. it's a condensate. You can also change coordinates to a Rindler-like coordinates. And okay, this is a little technical, but basically for the GR aficionados, it's kind of nice that you get a construction which generalizes the Israel junction conditions to a null boundary. And so you can actually understand this discontinuity. And the important thing is that the Rindler coordinates don't continue inside to changing sign of time and space, but because you have a discontinuity, everything remains real and positive. Time is time. And in a sense, this is more faithful, I would say, to Einstein's equivalence principle. So it all comes out of classical GR. People said, when we first proposed these ideas 16, 17 years ago, well, you know, you have to violate GR and so forth. But you see, if you're violating it at all, you're violating it in a very mild way, because this is all coming out of the Einstein equations themselves, of course, if I allow for this surface energy density to appear, which, of course, has to be explained independently. So let me try to finish up and then be open for questions. So if such a thing exists, you immediately get some very interesting qualitative conclusions, semi-quantitative conclusions. First of all, I should remark that this surface tension is positive. If it had come out the other way, we'd be in trouble, right? Because what a positive surface tension tells you is that if you increase the area by putting ripples on this surface, it costs you energy. So just like a soap bubble is stable because it has a positive surface tension. The physics is, of course, completely different. It has to do with the attraction of molecules in the surface. But it's satisfying that this comes out positive. So that doesn't prove stability, but it's certainly a necessary condition for stability. It means that I would expect in a dynamical model to have area fluctuations, bounded surface. I'm going to have a discrete set of modes on this surface. The surface tension acts as a restoring force. The surface oscillation should be stable. And the normal modes of this membrane, if you wish, are discrete. So this makes real the membrane paradigm. The characteristic frequency, okay, depends on the mass of the object, but it could be interesting for some gravitational wave detectors, and it predicts a discrete spectrum. So we can start to think about what, you know, black hole or gravistar, if you wish, spectroscopy would look like, and it would look different. So it's about as different as, you know, the Bohr atom is from the classical picture of an electron spiraling down into a singularity, which was the main problem at the beginning of the 20th century. Another observation. You can look at the geodesics, the null rays, as they hit the surface, and they're refracted, not surprisingly. And because you have a negative pressure, P equals minus rho in here, they're actually refracted the opposite way. In other words, it's a defocusing lens rather than a focusing lens. And so from Snell's law, you can figure out what the relationship of the angles here are. B is the impact parameter of the ray. And so the imaging characteristics of such an object should be quite different. Okay, if I put a light source behind it, first of all, the light can get through, possibly. I have to tell you how it interacts with the surface, but at least kinematically in the geometric optics approximation, it's not black. It can shine through, okay? And the image is completely different. I mean, of course, on the outside, it's still Schwarzschild, so you still get all the stuff that A.B. Broderick and friends are looking for in Sagittarius A star. But if I could actually control what's going on behind here, and provided that light can really get through, I mean, you know, this is geometric optics. Real light will no doubt interact with the surface in some way, get scattered, and so one has to do a more complicated, more detailed calculation. But for sure, the imaging should be different. Yeah.
The null rays you shoot in one side and that they said to get out in a finite proper time according to its observer.
Good. So in the limit where this is literally a delta function, literally infinitely thin, the time goes logarithmically to infinity. Okay. So if this, you know, this is of course was a classical construction. It's probably not the full answer, right? We expect some kind of quantum fluctuation. I'll talk about in a second. But the time frame is only logarithmically growing. So if there's a regulator there, even Planckian, it will get out in a finite time. But in the delta function, it's literally infinite. So, by the way, that could also produce interesting observational effects if you could figure out something about, you know, had a time-dependent source and could compare time delays from inside and outside. That would also be a test of these ideas. So let me try to summarize this anyway, and leave the last couple of minutes open. So the Buchtel bound, I think, is underappreciated because under these very restrictive conditions, granted, because that's what you need to do to assume, to calculate, to, you know, prove a theorem, and it's telling you that something should happen even before you reach the Schwarzschild radius. It's of course adiabatic. It's not a picture in which you have a rapid fast collapse, but at least under the static or very slowly varying adiabatic conditions, the Buchtel bound is telling you it doesn't matter what you put inside. Under spherical symmetry, something's got to give, okay, and give before it reaches the Schwarzschild radius. The constant density interior Schwarzschild solution, which is 1916, saturates the bound, and we believe shows generic behavior. You can look at other cases, but basically, looking at the limiting case is very instructive, I would say. There's infinite redshift at the central pressure. Infinite redshift at the central pressure divergence, but it gives an integrable Kolmar energy. This is this delta function, and it's integrable. So you get a finite surface tension. A couple of other remarks. Non-analyticity, this cusp, is, you know, very suggestive in terms of the original ideas we were thinking about. In stat-mech and Bose-Einstein condensation, it's very suggestive, right, of some underlying theory. So you use the, you know, words emergent, but general relativity is basically telling you that there can be something like a phase boundary when the function f of r, which is basically the effective speed of light, changes sign. Where c squared tries to change sign or goes to zero, something funny should happen there. And that is ultimately has to be a quantum or a statistical quantum effect. I already said the Hamiltonian in this background. That's a nice little problem to work out the quantization in this background. Now, you asked last time about the time delay. So you can estimate basically from those energy momentum arguments I gave you first that there should be a physical length scale at which quantum effects first come in when those quantum terms become comparable to, not infinite, but comparable to the classical terms. And because, well, it is at the Planck scale in the radial coordinate, but remember the metric has a dr squared over this h of r. So the physical length scale is actually a square root, a geometric mean of the Planck scale and the Schwarzschild radius. So this is, of course, tiny from the point of view of astrophysics and very hard to see, but it's also huge compared to the Planck scale, which means you ought to be able to trust some kind of semi-classical analysis there. But it's going to be hard to see unless you can probe down to this scale. This is, you know, put in numbers, this is a fraction of a Fermi for a solar mass black hole. So it's small on astrophysical scales, and that's your answer to your question about the time delay. Okay, this epsilon is essentially L Planck over the Schwarzschild radius. All right, so I think I've already said these things. I can't help remarking, since I did give a talk about this in the early days at Santa Barbara, and a dear late Joe Polchinski was there and didn't like it, okay? And, you know, we had some discussions afterwards. But then comes back later on, 10 years later, so it talks about firewalls, okay? So this is not a firewall because it's cold, okay? So it's a quite different picture we had than the one that, you know, AMS and others proposed years later. So, you know, I think that, you know, we're led to this thing from various considerations, but you know, partly statistical mechanics. The other interesting direction this takes you is that vacuum energy could be dynamical, because after all, you have to make this vacuum condensate somehow in a sufficiently cold and dense system. But if vacuum energy is dynamical, that might have other consequences for things like cosmology. Okay? So we would like to think about that too. I guess I'm now slated to give you some talks on just about the conformal anomaly, which is the direction I've been working for the last few years to give, you know, to make essentially a more microscopic effective theory of how this could happen, how this model could actually be realized. So in the last negative 2 minutes, I'll just mention, I mentioned imaging. So another thing which Niesh here and others have been thinking about is whether you could see this in gravitational waves. So the boundary conditions on the surface are going to be different because it's not horizon. You have to match inner and outer modes. If you look at the static spherically symmetric solution again, we have an interior and exterior solution, so we know what the wave equation is, and we can match the two solutions. This is a little exercise, which should be worked out. And notice, the point is, since the interior is regular, then there's an ordinary centrifugal barrier. So if you have any angular momentum modes other than S waves, you expect it to reflect off this barrier. So this is taken from these papers by Pani Cardozo and others who sometimes hear. And they pointed this out as well, that most of what the LIGO experiment is seeing are the signal in the ring down phase is mostly coming just from the light ring and the waves falling in from there. But if there's some delay, and so if it's a black hole, it just disappears, that's the end of it. You don't expect anything new. But if there's something else, and they consider even more exotic objects, I would say wormholes, or they call these compact objects, exotic compact objects, although I object a little bit to that. But anyway, if you have a centrifugal barrier, then inside this light ring, these waves can reflect back. And with some logarithmically long time, not a very long time, since that's only factors of 20, 30, or 40, this thing will bounce out and come out again, you know, with some much smaller amplitude. So that means, in principle, we can probe Planck scale physics, at least in the radial coordinate. So these are also some toy models from their paper that the ring down is not testing the existence of a horizon. And we had a workshop here. It was here last November. And, you know, all this was hotly debated. The LIGO folks think, I think reasonably, that, you know, this is not enough to claim they've seen a signal. But, you know, I think Niesh has done a very good thing by getting them to think about this, and they start looking for it. So maybe an era of black hole spectroscopy is coming. I could stop here. Avery is not here. I was expecting him to come and object. So I prepared a slide for him. I don't know if I should do that or not. I'll just say it. People like Narayan at Harvard and others have argued like this, like for a number of years, even from the beginning of our papers, that there should be horizons because there are a number of objects which we know accrete, and we know something about their accretion rate. And when accretion falls onto surfaces of ordinary compact objects like white dwarfs or neutron stars, some kind of boundary layer forms, The inflow is thermalized and re-radiated. So if one knows the mass accretion rate and doesn't see any thermal radiation, there must be no surface. That's basically the argument. And of course, in astrophysics, things are put into boxes as neutron stars or black holes based on whether you see something coming out or not. So that's the operational definition of a black hole. But you know, this surface is clearly something very different from the surface of a neutron star. And I would not expect it to form a photosphere. Since we have adiabatic solutions for any mass, it means that if the accretion is slow enough, you have to somehow convert this stuff that's falling in to the interior. There has to be a dynamical process, right? I mean, in which material can be absorbed and turned into the surface. So that would look just like a black hole. Nothing would come out if the accretion flow were slow enough. Also, you have to worry about the equilibration time scale. They're assuming thermal equilibrium, and the question is whether you can really thermalize if you have this very, you know, drastic slowing of time near the horizon. Also, I think they didn't really take into account that this is a very deeply redshifted surface we're talking about. This is a very small epsilon. You know, it's very tough for rays to get out. So basically, unless they come out to a very small angle, they don't get out at all. So you're looking at, you know, you're looking at a black body through a pinhole. Not much is going to get out in the normal circumstances. So all of this is, you know, I haven't given you a full model, so there are, of course, questions are open, but I don't think these arguments are sufficient to rule out this idea. All right, that's kind of where I want to end. So we want to think about all these different possibilities. Nobody asked, but you should ask. John has been bugging me. What happened to the baryons? So of course, I've got to figure out some, I mean, this doesn't address the question of formation. And that's a much harder question. And for that, you need a dynamical theory. You can't rely on just static solutions. I've been thinking also about implications maybe for cosmology, if you have a dynamical vacuum energy, and it could appear in other ways. So in any case, this is a, for the moment, viable solution. And you know, I'm happy to have it criticized, and that's one reason I'm here, is to hear everyone attack me and see what a, but you know, this is a reasonable idea, I think, that has to be experimentally verified or disproved. And it's a possibility that requires a lot more work, and I'm hoping can get at least some people interested in it. Thanks, I'll stop. So who's the chair? You're the chair. You.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Maybe start at the top. Somebody will finish it.
Oh, good. Okay.
First line. So why isn't there something that smells fishy when you can think of, let me take a 10 to 10 to the natural mass black hole. So I'm 45 orders of magnitude away from Planck. Yeah. I have a density that is lower than that of air.
Yeah.
I have a curvature that is flatter than that of Earth.
Yeah.
Why in the world would anything related to quantum have anything to do with our reality?
But that's the statement which I made right at the beginning.
Yeah, but
that it's that it doesn't have to do with local curvatures. Period. Local curvatures are what point particles feel, but you have to think about waves. You have to think about gravitational. You have to think about quantum effects on scales of the order of the horizon, which this is a coherence effect. So you're not going to get that by thinking about local curvatures.
The density argument doesn't tell you everything either.
I mean that is basically coming from, you know, just you should be basically starting your criticism here. Because how is it a quantum effect? There's an H bar. How is it a quantum effect? No matter how big M is, take it as big as you like. Okay, there's still a range where this thing overcomes that. So if there are quantum effects like this, and then you can look at these effects and ask, do I believe these states, or how can that state be formed? That's fine, and I'll give you some arguments for that when we talk about the conformal anomaly.
This is the Tristan's but,
well, the point is everything becomes massless near the horizon. Because it's, I mean, as many people have noticed, there's conformal behavior near the horizon. And that, you know, you can see that from the wave equation, that you know, everything, the mass has become irrelevant. Any finite mass becomes, so anyway, that's the thing you ought to struggle with, right? How can this quantum effect be there? Because that contradicts what you said, right? Here is a large, macroscopically large quantum effect, no matter how big the mass is, no matter how small the local curvature is. It's because I know about infinity, because because I know about the state globally, not just locally. That's quantum mechanics.
That would be the first example where we build something.
No. No, a superconductor is fundamentally quantum. And it's, if you cool anything down, you eventually reach a quantum state, which is very different than your classical intuitions.
Very open. So here
no, I can have, you know, I can have a superconductor that's the size of the table. Even though you know, I usually think quantum mechanics, oh, it's about, you know, atomic scales, the Bohr radius. But no, right? I can, if the waves get.
A superconductor, the intrinsic physics scale that is governing everything, is very close to Planck length, so whatever the Planck to quantum scales. Here, we're so far from quantum scales, and then you say, well,
So there's an interplay, right? There's an interplay. In a sense, you are getting very, very close. Okay, you have to get very close to the horizon, but it's over the whole horizon. So there's an interplay between, and that's why conformal ideas have to somehow be relevant here, because you can't make an object like this at one mass. You have to make it at every mass, or else you haven't solved the problem. But there is an interplay between infrared and ultraviolet, for sure. Otherwise it's not going to happen.
Same way in a BEC, the coherence length is much bigger than the intrinsic quantum. Or like a laser, the coherence length.
A laser.
Right. Yeah. I think you should go to the chairman. Who should I take the question? It's someone in the back. Let me go to the back first, John. Yeah, because we can argue all the time, right? Yeah. Yeah.
So I suppose you can expect a large pure quantum state if your quantum system is closed. If it doesn't interact with something else, that something else will fly off. I come from the side. So do you have any reason to expect that a black hole that you're describing is a closed system? Like,
well, to the extent you can ignore, you know, being slammed by other objects or large accretion. Of course, when there's accretion, it's not closed. But you know, the object in the center of our galaxy is pretty quiescent. So, just like I solved for a neutron star equation of state, ignoring the rest of the universe, I don't see why I can't solve for an isolated object, whether it's a black hole or something else. No, I mean.
It's a
human blood space. Yeah. I mean, of course, in the real world, things interact. I have to worry about it. Yeah, one of the nice little problems I've been thinking about since I'm here is to go a little bit away from this and do a phenomenology of asking how, if I put a slow accretion rate, can I actually calculate how the surface changes, okay, without doing too much violence to it. Obviously, if I hit this thing, you know, with a collision, it's going to something much more violent is going to happen, which requires a much more detailed theory. Yeah.
So the cusp at the horizon, is the derivative equal and opposite on the two sides?
Yes.
So if you take the square root of it and look at the tetrad, is it possible that's just analytic? I would think of that as a more physical thing.
That's an interesting question. I haven't done that. Look at it.
Very analogous to like the radiation dominated Big Bangs,
uh-huh. Well, there is, I think, a delta function in the Riemann tensor components. Yeah. So it's not, you're not going to just eliminate it, but maybe you can relate it to some frame-dependent effect. That's an interesting question. I mean, I'm thinking about this very naively, in undergraduate E&M, right? We all learn that if there's a surface density, then the Gauss's law tells you there's a discontinuity in the electric field. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing, except you're on a null surface. And you have to do the GR right. But otherwise, it's the same idea, essentially. But the question... Yeah, there may be, yeah. But I've been thinking about, you know...
It's like an analogous thing with when you consider, a conductor and you get the method damages or the...
Yeah, but I want to think about topological effects and that, you know, whether or not, you know, if you really put the theory as a fiber bundle, how do you describe this effect there? I mean, what is the right topological understanding of this? But okay, that we should talk about.
So there's like a later question, but like, what's the argument behind the pressure divergence as we come to balance parity? Because for me, like, seems to be very complex, but like, I don't see why we should, like, this, what's the argument behind this divergence as we forbid the black hole from formation?
What's the origin of the divergence? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just solving, I mean, it's just a, it's just that the constant density solution will not support the static solution unless the pressure goes negative. I don't know. It's just a property of the solution.
Is it physical interpretation?
Well, physical, you know, is that when you put a negative pressure, it's basically pushing back. It's producing an outward going force. So you keep pushing. Something gives. And it's interesting, I think, that Einstein's equations allow that to happen. They know that can happen, okay? So they don't know anything about matter, what the equation of state is. You know, that has to come from a much more microscopic theory. But just the energy balance and the pressure tells you that if you keep pushing this thing, something has to happen there. That's a repulsive force has to counterbalance it or there's no solution. That's what it tells you. Yeah. Go ahead, John. Talk to you later.
What else to the left? So, that's the geo. The rest of it is the same. It's something else.
Right.
And it's supposed to be kept happy. Because pain was one of those cosmic sensations. You can never see it. So, you know, if you really.
Yeah, you've got to convert ordinary matter to this. Yeah.
Something happens to me.
Right.
So the argument is that the only knowledge of itself is the telling. So again, part of physics has to come in.
Yeah.
It's a kind of a phase transition.
Yeah.
However, tunneling is exponentially small. So someone has to work out.
Yeah, I mean, you have large energies here, so you're not just. Yeah, I agree. But.
I'm not
criticizing. No, that's fine.
But,
yeah, we can talk some more. Let's hear some more.
So, I have a question and a comment.
Yes.
So, the question is, so you talk about this, the mode of the surface. You're saying they're all stable because the tension.
They appear to be stable. One has to do a calculation.
One has to do a complete analysis. Like you have the space time itself plus the membrane, and then ask a question whether the load of this the whole system is stable or not. It does not have to be.
You're right. Yeah. You're right. I mean, if the surface tension is not negative, it would be unstable. So it's a good sign that the surface tension is positive.
Yes.
But it's not sufficient.
Yeah.
One has to have a full dynamic. You know, you have to redo Chandra Sekhar basically. You have to redo the small oscillations and matching conditions
and started to work on that. But the point is that you need to make some assumption about what's happening. You need to put something, there's need for more information to do the either microscopic theory or effective theory. So actually, if you look at hydrogen atoms and bubbles, that's what people do. They introduce additional terms in the obvious stokes, and then you can actually do a small oscillation analysis. So it's kind of phenomenology, and I'd be able to do that here.
So the comment is the other, because you're talking about black star instead of dark holes, the other observational signature in addition to echo would be measuring the tidal log number of the black star, right? So dark hole, we know the tidal, there's no tidal response, tidal log number is zero, but I think for black star it must be down zero. So you can calculate that and use, let's say, the existing
finite. I would love to be able to calculate that. Again, it's going to take some model, either a microscopic theory or a phenomenological model of how the surface responds to the stress.
You think that will care about what it does as long as the measure is the same? We should probably figure out, think of the next time.
There's another talk.
Yeah. But let's take a look at it.